Hello, I'm Michelle Grattan, and welcome back to the Conversations Politics podcasts. We'll have plenty of political interviews for you in this election year of 2016. We're starting with Tony Burke, who's the manager of opposition business in the House of Representatives, as well as shadow finance minister, an especially heavy load in an election year. One of his prime tasks has been the pursuit of savings to pay for Labor's ambitious menu of policies to be put to the voters. Labor says it's already identified some $70 billion in savings. Actually, many of them would be tax rises. But the question is whether they will be enough to persuade the electorate that it has a credible fiscal policy. Tony Burke, a large part of Labor savings come from tax increases, varying from changes to superannuation arrangements to rises in the tax on cigarettes. Yet Treasury Secretary John Fraser stressed in a speech last week that spending programs must be tackled. Is it just too hard to tackle spending?
Well, no, you need to do both. And John Fraser's speech makes clear that you need to do both. If you go back to the last time that the budget was in broad balance, which is back in 2002, you had both expenditure and revenue running at around 25% as a percentage of GDP. What's happened since? Revenue is below, expenditure is above. Now, the gap, it's actually revenue that's been the steepest shift, but it means you have both an expenditure and a revenue problem. So what needs to happen is you need over time to have the spending cuts that bring revenue down. You need the expenditure cuts that bring that as a percentage of GDP down. You need the improvements in revenue to bring that up. You also need to have a period of time where expenditure is lower than revenue, because if you're not doing that, then you're not paying back down the debt and getting us into a position of strength so we're able to deal with the next global shock. Now, that's a medium-term objective to be able to do that, but it needs to be done. What does that mean? It means the sorts of cuts to spending that we've already announced, like abolishing the emissions reduction fund, like not reintroducing the baby bonus, like not going ahead with the plebiscite that we now know from the government members that it would make absolutely no difference in how they vote anyway. You need to continue the pathway of making strategic cuts to bring expenditure down. But if you do as the Treasurer has done, which is to maintain the fiction that we only have an expenditure problem, then you will never be able to deal structurally with the challenges that the budget faces.
Spending is now 25.9% of GDP, due to fall to 25.3% over the forward estimates. Where do you think it should land in the longer term?
Well, that answer will depend on the state of the economy. And sometimes we have discussions about the fiscal, the fiscals of the budget, and we have them as though it's an issue devoid from where the economy is at. The great strength of what was done by Labor during the global financial crisis was that we acknowledged that the private sector was in retreat, so government needed to move in to make sure that we maintained employment during that period. In the same way, as the private sector comes back, that's when the government moves back. You have a fiscal consolidation, and that makes sure that your finances are strong enough that when the next global shock comes, you're ready and in a position to be able to act again. So I don't think there's a magic number that will always be right as an answer to that question. What you do need, though, is to work on the basis that broad balance, historically, has been when the numbers are around 25. Now, when we were in government, we consistently kept it below 25, certainly for the final 3 years. Expenditure was less than 25% as a percentage of GDP. Now, we're going to need to get back down to those numbers and get down there for a period of time to get the fiscal consolidation. But you always need to make fine judgments based on where the economy is at. The greatest fault of the 2014 budget was that the government hit the household budget so hard that it had an impact on confidence. And what did you end up with as a result? No matter what they thought was going to happen on budget night, we ended up with the budget in a worse position, because when confidence takes a hit, that ricochets throughout the economy.
Now, of course, we don't know the detail on either side yet, but is this election shaping up as one with one side promising income tax and the other side, your side, promising higher spending in education and health?
Where I think we're heading is to... It's slightly different to where we were heading when Tony Abbott was there. Tony Abbott just denied that the future existed, whereas Malcolm Turnbull is acknowledging the changes that are happening with the future. So for each side of politics, I think the political divide will be how you deal with that. And Labor's approach is to make sure you deal with it in a way that maintains confidence for business and for consumers by not attacking the household budget. That part of it gets us to the GST debate. And then also make sure that we're investing in what Australia will need post the mining boom. And that's where some people have wanted to characterise the education spending as though it is purely, you know, social spending, purely an issue of fairness. This is a strategic economic investment. You know, effectively, during the mining boom, the future of an Australian child, you know, in terms of what was going to matter with the economy during the mining boom was very much what was below their feet. Now, it's going to be very much what's on top of their shoulders. And that investment in the minds and the intelligence and the creativity of the next generation of Australians will become our competitive economic advantage.
Yet I get the impression that it's quite hard for Labor to get out that message to say, yes, we're spending more money in education, but it has these important economic spin-offs. I know it's said, but it's not getting across very well.
The reality in opposition is the government megaphone is always louder than the opposition's megaphone. And so you need to simply take every single opportunity and keep explaining the story. But parents
or
understand
explain it better.
I think it's true to say that parents understand it. Parents understand that if their child has a better education, then they're going to have a better opportunity in the new economy that's coming. They do understand that. People also understand that the days where your first employer would be the employer you stayed with right through to retirement are the days of an era long gone now. These shifts are understood out there. And, you know, tell anybody who's spending a whole lot of money on private education that money's irrelevant to educational outcomes. People have a sense of when a school is underfunded. People have a sense of when their children are not being given the investment that's required for the future. What we're talking about is simply, you know, when you amplify that out to a national outcome.
In the tax debate, Treasurer Scott Morrison is talking all the time about bracket creep and how this is going to hurt ordinary wage earners. Do you think, does Labor think, that bracket creep is actually not a major problem?
I find Scott Morrison's comments about bracket creep breathtaking, absolutely breathtaking. In terms of the record on this, the record of the current government has been to make bracket creep worse. If you're at the top end of the income tax scale, they added 2% to the income tax scale there under what they called a deficit levy, after which the deficit has only got worse. If you're at the lower end of the income tax scale, the only shift they've made was to remove a measure that dealt with bracket creep, which was going to change the tax-free threshold from $18,200 to $19,400. So their record in this term of government has been to make bracket creep worse. Our record for the last 30 years has been to deal with bracket creep. Right back to Hawke Keating taking the top tax bracket from 60%, 60 cents in the dollar down to 49 cents in the dollar, and the company tax rate from 46 cents down to 33, right through to the last term of government when we more than tripled the tax-free threshold and took more than 1 million people completely out of the tax system. Our record on bracket creep leaves theirs for dead. But what they're wanting to do is quite a sneaky manoeuvre, because they're wanting to claim they're dealing with bracket creep by providing the revenue to shift the tax brackets at the same time that you increase the GST by 5%. or by 50% off the base, but you know, take it from 10 to 15. Now, nothing hits the household budget more than a tax on consumption. It's a very direct hit. But a tax increase on the GST is a permanent hit to the household budget. A shift to deal with bracket creep on the income tax scales is a temporary improvement in the household budget, because it will get eaten up into the future by bracket creep. The GST hike becomes permanent and remains there. So what Scott Morrison is saying is, well, he pretends to be dealing with bracket creep. Yes, he's saying he'll shift the income tax scale, but by doing it through the GST, he's providing something that at best will be a fix for a year or two only, but will leave a structural problem where people will have the hit permanent, the compensation temporary.
Some Labor people, you included, have been very sharp about South Australian Premier Jay Weatherall, who's essentially saying that Federal Labor hasn't so far faced up to the longer-term revenue problems. Weatherall is willing to accept that that would require an increase in the GST. He believes lower income earners can be adequately compensated if you go down that route. Wouldn't an increase in the GST actually be better than further spending cuts, even if it's not a desirable option in itself?
I don't accept that that's the only choice, because we've already shown you can get improvements in revenue without attacking the household budget in that way. That's what we've done with high-income superannuation tax concessions. It's what we've done with multinational tax avoidance. It's what we've also done with the tobacco excise, where even though it raises a large amount of money, it's still less than what tobacco-related disease costs the health budget. So we've shown already, and there'll be more to come, that there are other ways of dealing with taxation than attacking the household budget. Mind you, I can see why Jay Weatherall feels he's in an impossible position. I mean, with $80 billion worth of cuts to schools and hospitals across the nation from the 2014 budget, which Tony Abbott brought in and Malcolm Turnbull is continuing to endorse, the state premiers are in an impossible position. But I'm pleased that overnight, Jay Weatherall has now acknowledged that our education expenditure is fully funded. That's been acknowledged. We haven't made our announcements in the health space yet, but every announcement that we make will continue to be fully funded.
In terms of savings, whether they're cuts or increases in some taxes, you will have more to put out.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. We've put out more at this stage of the electoral cycle in terms of improvements to the budget bottom line than any opposition in living memory. But we certainly haven't put out our whole program yet.
But you haven't put out your whole savings either.
Well, no. Yeah. And Chris Bowen has made clear of our fiscal rule for, I think, more than a year now, which is that over the decade we'll make sure for our commitments that there are more saves and spends across the decade. Now, sometimes what oppositions do is they announce the spends and say, oh, look, we'll give you our tax package later. What we've been doing has been unheard of, which is to announce the improvements of revenue well in advance of expenditure decisions.
Mind you, costing things across a decade always seems to me a bit of an exercise in fantasy. Surely the forward estimate period, 4 years, is about all you can realistically talk about, and as we know, that changes dramatically anyway. But 10 years?
There's some changes that you would never make were you not doing a 10-year projection. So if take, for example, and this is where the interaction of the tobacco excise and the superannuation tax concessions is quite important. Some people have said, quite rightly, that if you have the health impact you're hoping to have with increases in tobacco excise, then over the long term that becomes a diminishing form of revenue. That's right. And so you need to be able to account for that. Superannuation tax concessions, when you have shifts there, over time, because of the increase in accumulated funds, raises significantly more money. Now, across the forward estimates, that change, if that was all you were going to make, you'd probably never bother to make it. But it's a long-term structural change that needs to be made. And if you go back to the speech from John Fraser, He refers to the concept of having a structural budget deficit, where you need to be able to look beyond where commodity prices are right now, what the unemployment rate is right now, and to be able to make sure that in the long term, you're dealing with the structural deficit. Now, if you only look within the forward estimates, you would never deal with the structural deficit in that way. But it also demands that you have a high level of rigour in any of those costings. And that's why we've made extensive use of the Parliamentary Budget Office in making sure that those projections not only go out to 10 years, but also have very conservative conditions built into them so that, you know, we presume that there will be a significant tapering off in smoking rates. We have conservative assumptions about the growth of superannuation funds, which means across 10 years you would expect to do better than what we've in fact estimated.
When you get those costings from the Parliamentary Budget Office, you give them the assumptions, is that right? They don't make the assumptions.
Oh no, there are some assumptions they'll insist on and other extra layers of being conservative that you'll ask for them to build in.
What sort of assumptions do they insist on?
Oh, well, they'll, you know, the growth rates for the economy and things like that, where unemployment's at, different projections that come from Treasury. You know, you can't as an opposition go in and say, well, we want to presume that growth's just going to go through the roof to make our numbers look better, or that there'll be high inflation and therefore on paper it'll look like the superannuation accumulation is much, much higher, and therefore when you take away a concession you get more revenue. You know, those sorts of games don't get played.
To go back to Joe Weatherall, the intensity of the attacks on him suggests that really he's hit a sore spot with federal Labor. Has his stand really made Bill Shorten's job more difficult in selling the anti-GST position?
Well, there are two separate comments that Joe Weatherall made. When Premier Weatherall questioned whether or not our education announcements had been fully funded, we had to come back against that very hard.
He says he didn't do that. He was talking more generally about health and education.
That's right.
And that health was the big thing, and it all got blurred in the
general
news reporting.
And he's clarified that overnight. But the comments that I made on Sunday morning were very much in the frame of asserting beyond any doubt that the education announcements we'd made were absolutely fully funded. But the second issue is on the GST itself and on a GST hike. And Federal Labor's position is twofold. One, we can understand that the state premiers have all been placed in an impossible position from this government. And so we do acknowledge the position that he's in. But we have a strong objection to a hike in the GST. And it would be deeply hypocritical of Federal Labor if we were only willing to argue our position in a tough way when it was a Liberal mouthing the words. If it's a Labor Premier mouthing the words, our position has to be just as firm. And I think we'd be quite rightly criticised if we were being apologetic and softening our language simply because it was a Labor Premier making the comments.
Now, you haven't announced your health policy, but we've heard the AMA say that there's a hospital funding crisis here or coming. We've heard Joe Weatherall say, and indeed Mike Baird, that this is going to be a massive funding problem in the longer term for the states. Do you agree that you're really going to need a very substantial federal policy on hospitals? And by the way, whatever happened to the promise by Kevin Rudd to fix it all up?
The promise that it be fixed was trashed in the 2014 budget by the government, and now everyone's looking around thinking, now everyone's looking at how on earth do we pick up the pieces from that 2014 budget. The challenge with health policy is really, where do you start? It's not simply an attack that we've been talking about in this conversation on the capacity of the states to be able to fund their hospitals. There's also been an all-out assault on Medicare and bulk billing. Now, that started under Tony Abbott, but what we discovered when MyEFO was brought down at the end of last year, that Malcolm Turnbull is continuing it with what they've done on diagnostics. So the challenges with the health budget don't only go to the challenges that the states have.
But they're all expensive, these challenges.
That's exactly right, and that is a problem that Labor faces. It is a problem that the current government faces. It is a problem that Australia has to deal with. Hospitals are part of that. They're not the only part of it.
But you do accept that dealing with these problems is going to be expensive?
Oh, for anyone who wants to be able to grapple with this, there are high costs involved with hospitals and with the entire health system, and costs that have been growing at a greater rate than anyone's budget.
Both sides of politics seem to be putting budget repair off almost into the never-never, whereas a few years ago they were focusing pretty heavily on it. How important do you think budget repair is as a priority, and how serious do you think the debt problem is?
Okay, I think it's worth getting all the way back to first principles as to why it's an important thing to do, because some people would just argue, debt is cheaper than it's been historically at different periods. It's gone up a bit of late. You know, people will ask, well, why deal with it at all? The global financial crisis was the best example, I think, where one of the reasons we were able to deal with it the way we were was because of the state of the books. And we want to make sure before the next global shock comes that we're well positioned as well. That's an important thing to be able to do. Countries that didn't have books as strong as Australia had weren't able to keep people in work through stimulus the way Australia was able to. So there is a good reason for wanting to be able to fix it. Now, the challenge is if you go too hard, too fast, you hit confidence and you have the reverse impact. And that was what unfolded after the 2014 budget. I think one of the questions which people are going to need to work their way through, and I don't have a concluded view on this, but I think it's worth raising. Going back to the comments from Glenn Stevens when he questioned whether or not our trend growth rate of 3% was something that we'd be able to continue to consider as the correct growth rate into the years ahead. Now, at the time, Joe Hockey just ruled it out and said, yes, of course it's 3. But can we continue to presume that trend is what we had during, you know, an average that involves the mining boom years? And that, I think, all your budget projections are affected by what you consider trend growth to be. And that's going to be something that both sides of politics are going to need to work through.
Do you think Australia's AAA credit rating is quite safe, or is it dependent on policy in the next 5-10 years?
Well, I think we have to take the Secretary of Treasury at his word. He wouldn't have raised it if he didn't think it was a significant issue. Now, we got the AAA credit rating from all three agencies when Wayne Swan was Treasurer. That's when we achieved that, and the Secretary of Treasury is now saying that's at risk. To be able to deal
with it... Well, to be fair to him, I think he didn't say it was at risk. He said we mustn't be complacent
I accept
and it
that.
Would depend what happened on the budget and also how the economy adjusted post-mining.
No, that's fair. I accept that. But he certainly deliberately has raised the issue. And he's raised it in a context where we must deal with both revenue and expenditure. We must deal with both. Now, up until that point, we had the Treasurer of Australia claiming we didn't need to deal with revenue, that we only had an expenditure problem and that revenue would look after itself. That can't be argued, I believe, with any credibility at all after the Secretary of Treasury has given the speech that we heard. Where do we go from there? It means that anybody who's saying we don't need to have any spending cuts is wrong. We do need to be able to rein in expenditure. Anyone who is saying that we don't need to pay attention at all to increasing revenue is also wrong. But the problem with the entire debate has been that some commentators have wanted to argue that you're not talking about revenue unless you're talking about a hike to the GST. And that's demonstrably wrong.
We've mentioned a number of times John Fraser's speech. What did you think of it overall? Were you impressed by it?
Yeah, I was. I was. I was concerned, and this is a concern that I think we've had in Australian economic debate for some time, which is that the rhetoric from a treasurer hasn't matched the facts. So in opposition, Joe Hockey continued to talk about a budget emergency, a budget crisis, claim that he'd deliver surpluses immediately, and claims that if you were to do that with the budget, it was pretty clear you were going to cause damage to the economy. Now, when Scott Morrison came in, there was an opportunity to change the rhetoric. And for reasons I don't understand, he didn't. He kept that rhetoric going. He kept the claims of it being an expenditure problem only, not a revenue problem at all. And I think what John Fraser has done is provide a very sober account of let's deal with the facts here, and if we deal with them appropriately, Australia's AAA credit ratings will remain intact, but we don't take them for granted. That was what made it significant. It was effectively a reining back in of rhetoric that's been coming from Australian treasurers for a couple of years that has borne no relationship to the reality or the needs of the Australian economy.
Just turning away from money matters, doesn't Labor need to take a more robust stand against bad behaviour in the union movement? It says it's against corruption, but it seemed more intent on attacking the Royal Commission than facing up to the evidence that's come out of that commission.
I think it's fair to say that when it comes to the specifics of dealing with corruption, our position has been robust. When you talk about increasing penalties for corrupt behaviour, that is a serious thing to do. When you talk about providing improved protection for whistleblowers, that's about making sure that future claims come to light. But when the government's approach is to say, well, they just want to go after one side of one argument in one industry, effectively you end up with the government wanting to run a party political agenda, the government wanting to be effectively just straight out anti-union, and Labor's approach is to be anti-corruption.
But Labor often sounds as though it's really protecting the unions, that's its first call, rather than saying, well, there are bad things being done and we must find ways of countering that.
Oh, I don't accept that. And I think wherever there's corrupt conduct, our position is clear that the authorities should act.
It's been reported in The Australian this week that internal polling shows that Labor could be in a really bad position in a number of seats, that indeed it could lose seats at the election. In light of this, do you think that it needs to change strategy at all? And do you think that Bill Shorten will indeed lead into the election?
Okay, well, the answer to the last question is yes. And then to go to the strategy. At an election, the day an election's called, every party starts with zero votes. That's where you're at, and you've got to make sure that by the time you get to election, the Australian people know exactly what you stand for and know the difference between yourself and your opponents. Now, we've been through a period where Malcolm Turnbull has been saying things, and a lot of what he's saying, people have thought at the first instance, at the very least, it's a lot better than what they had been hearing from Tony Abbott. But a Prime Minister doesn't just say things. A Prime Minister also has to make decisions and do things. And Malcolm Turnbull can't unleash the debate that he's been unleashing and just saying, oh, I'm just having a conversation without a GST, and sail all the way to the election without having a position on changes in tax. We've been putting out different changes over the last 12 months. Each time we've announced something, they've rubbished it, they've attacked it, and now's the time. It's unusual for there to be more policy on the table from an opposition than a government, but that's where we've been. Now's the time where people won't just see what Malcolm Turnbull says, they'll see what Malcolm Turnbull does. And that is a critical change in the political debate. Sometimes when we've been giving interviews on the GST increase or on cuts to penalty rates, people will say, oh yeah, but Malcolm Turnbull hasn't actually done that yet. And that's true. He's given pretty strong signals as to where he's headed. But the Australian public won't react fully to something until they see the government take the decision. And you know, that's why we can't let the government try to get away with simply delaying this debate and decisions on it, as one article claimed today might be possible, until right on the eve of an election. So it's our task to bring these issues to the fore right now, and ultimately the public will judge Malcolm Turnbull when they see him doing things. The first marker of that, really in a big way, will be when he brings down his own budget. Let's not forget, with Tony Abbott, people didn't really know what he was about until budget night 2014. And the first real test, real change for people's views of Malcolm Turnbull, and when they judge, are his policies really different, or is this just gift wrapping on a rubbish bin, will be on budget night this year.
Can we end on an issue that won't be finalised before the election, and that is gay marriage? There's been a debate in the Liberal Party, among Liberals, in the last week or so about whether they would or should be bound to vote for implementation of gay marriage if the promised plebiscite delivered a yes vote. Now, Labor's policy is for a conscience vote, as it came out of the federal conference, in at least for the next few years. So if the coalition were returned and that plebiscite came out with a yes result, would Labor MPs have the conscience vote still on the question of implementation, or would this policy be visited again?
Oh, look, there's a series of ifs on legislation not written. So the principle for Labor is that there's a conscience vote on this issue, and that the vote on the substantive issue itself should be held within the parliament. We view the plebiscite as effectively $160 million thrown out the window for no good purpose.
That might be true, but nevertheless,
we have a conscience vote on the substantive issue.
So after a successful plebiscite, Labor MPs would have a conscience vote on implementation.
I'm not dealing with the if a plebiscite, no a plebiscite, because our position is there shouldn't be one, and we would oppose
that. But whenever this came up in Parliament...
On the issue itself, we have a conscience vote on the issue, when we believe that vote should be brought forward.
Tony Burke, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Always a pleasure, Michelle.